It's the Burt Cohen Show. History is one of those things you learn in school. And I gotta tell you, when I was growing up in the 1950s, education was extremely valued. It was one of the highest valued things that there was in America. We all, Democrats and Republicans, recognized how important education was. And on the last presidential debate, the moderator, Bob Schieffer, you know, when he could see that the two candidates, Romney and Obama, were just falling all over themselves about teachers, Bob Schieffer said, "We all love teachers. Now, basically, get on with it." But what are you going to do about education in America? Things have changed quite a bit on education, and there's a great deal at stake in this year's presidential election when it comes to education. I'm very pleased to have with us today Dennis Van Rokel, former math teacher and now head of the largest educators union, the National Education Association. Dennis, thanks so much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show.
Oh, it's good to be here. Thank you.
Well, Romney agreed with the president, well, he wants to appeal to women, obviously, that education is crucial to our economic future. But I wonder, you know what's really going on behind the sound bites and the shall we say, dishonesty spins, things like that. Tell us about what the differences really are between Mr. Obama and Mr. Romney's vision and how it might affect my children and, you know, students all across the United States.
All right. I'd love to do that. Yeah, that it was kind of strange during the debate because I thought we've now seen three Mitt Romneys. The first one was during the Republican primary. And then as his campaign manager said, once you go in the general, you use Etch-a-Sketch. And I think he did that very well in transforming himself into someone else. And then in the debates, he became Mitt Romney number three. And I don't believe that people will fail to see this change and that they have to wonder who he really is. But based on his record, I think we kind of have a better idea than by what the words he said in the debate. I mean, this, as he tries to do it both ways or three ways, he says he praises teachers, he loves teachers, but then he knocks the teacher unions. And the idea that you could separate the members and the union is just crazy. The teachers are the union, and so you can't say I love one and not the other. He says he cares about kids in school, and then he says class size doesn't matter. It does matter. You can ask any parent in America whose child's in a classroom, they know. And he really switched on whether education is a key to building the economy. In the debate, he said, yes, it was. And to the Des Moines Register a little bit later, he said, no, hiring teachers won't grow the economy. I think the fundamental difference is that Obama's message has been consistent. He's talked about from early childhood to graduate. He increased Pell Grants. He fixed the loan program so the banks don't get the money, but students striving to get an education get the money. He protected class size and essential programs by saving the jobs of 400,000 adults who worked in those schools. And he understands the power of education for the individual to follow their dream, for economic development so that the entire workforce is educated and trained well enough to succeed, and for America's competition in this global society. So I think President Obama has put forth a consistent and real message about education that is for all of America's children, not for some, where Romney continues to favor a few over the many.
Yeah, there has been that pattern. That's one of the few things that seems to be what little core there may be in Mitt Romney, favoring the few over the many, if you look down underneath the glossy words. Now, a lot of people have been, you know, as you said, saying, oh, we all love teachers, but we don't like the teachers' union. Now, and there has been some pressure, as I'm sure you're aware, Mr. Van Roekel, to link teacher pay to performance. Now, what's wrong with that? And I imagine that might be something that Mr. Romney might be in favor of.
Well, one of the main problems, and first of all, let me say one thing about separating teachers from their union, one other comment.
Sure.
I was a high school teacher, as you mentioned, a high school math teacher for 23 years. And that first year of teaching, I believed if I cared enough and I worked hard enough, I could deliver for every one of my students. But you soon realize you can't, because there are so many decisions made outside of the classroom by policymakers at the local, state, and national. And that's what brought me into the association, to my union. I wanted to have a voice with policymakers so that I could tell them, in my words, what their policies meant to the students in my classroom, how it impacted them. And so to me, my union is just the extension of me so that my voice is in that debate, rather than having the debate by policymakers and no one who actually spends their life, their professional life, with students in the classroom is ever there to talk. So as we look at this thing about education and how to change that, how to fix it, how to make it better, I think one of the things that we have to do is that we're going to have to invest in early childhood. All the countries in the world that are doing better than we are, that are held up, that's where they put the investment. That's where you level that playing field so that all kids have that opportunity to pursue it. And the second thing I think as we pursue this is that we're going to have to deal with the affordability of higher education. It's soon going to be out of the grasp except just for a wealthy few, and that just can't be in the 21st century. We know that we need a higher and better educated citizenry than ever in our history, so we can't come to a point where only those who have a lot of resources are able to obtain that kind of education.
You would think that's just, well, as they say, kind of a no-brainer, but it's not. There's a lot of differences of opinion on that. And certainly at times during the campaign, Mitt Romney kowtowed to the hard right, the so-called Tea Party. And I was remembering back when I was in the New Hampshire State Senate, there were some kind of right-wing senators who referred to public schools as government schools. And a lot of these, you've probably heard this before, Dennis Van Roekel, and a lot of people feel like there's something basically that it's like indoctrination of students. And they want to have, they say that schools are like anything else in the economy. It needs more competition.
Yeah.
Paint a picture of what it might look like if this group of extreme right wingers somehow took power under Romney administration.
Well, if it's privatized, if it becomes in that market and competitive environment, then it really does figure out who wins and who loses, and a smaller number. And as you mentioned earlier, Mr. Romney has really always supported that in what he's done. As governor, he cut funds for public schools. He had teacher layoffs. He raised the tuitions at colleges and university in double digits because he cut their funding. And all of that was done in order to pay for tax cuts for the wealthy, for this small group. And when you look at the Romney-supported Ryan budget, it does the same thing. It cuts $115 billion from education, cuts things like Pell Grants, Head Start, special education. And again, all of those funds that are taken away are used to give a tax cut for the very wealthy. So I just think the whole area of privatization, of focusing on a few, is the wrong direction for America. And that gives us such a distinct choice between Mitt Romney and President Obama that I think President Obama has said over and over that he understands the middle class. He understands that the issue of college affordability, that it has to be all students, not some. So Mitt Romney, that mental model just keeps showing when he talked about all kids should have the education they can afford.
Ooh.
Well, again, it's if you have the money, then you get it. If you don't, I'm sorry. And to me, that is just not a way to go for us in this country.
Wow. We've never been, except maybe in the Gilded Age, I don't know, a society of, you know, aristocrats have one level and everybody else is just a peasant without any rights. And if you're born a peasant, you stay a peasant. That's not the traditional American way. And
no, it isn't. And one of my favorite memorials here in Washington, D.C. is the FDR. And there's a quote there that I think so, all those though said so many years ago, it actually defines very clearly the difference in the views of Mitt Romney and President Obama. And FDR was talking about America, and I mean, think of the timing. It was after the Great Depression. And he was talking about how we as a nation measure our progress. And he said the test of our progress should not be whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much, but whether we provide enough for those who have too little. And that really is the battle. The people who have too little opportunity, too little access, too little equity, versus those that already have so much. And the debate on taxes is everybody paying their fair share? When it comes to education, Mitt Romney supports vouchers for private schools.
Yes.
He wants all the education you could afford. Again, it's placing the needs of a few over the needs of the many. So I think that clearly defines our two visions. And for me, for NEA and our 3 million members, we believe there's only one real choice when it comes to education or future, and that's to reelect President Obama.
We are talking on the Burt Cohen Show with a former math teacher and now head of the nation's largest educators union, the National Education Association, Dennis Van Roekel. And certainly when I was growing up, it was just a given that education was essential for our economy. And I wonder if there's a deliberate effort, quite possibly, by some of the corporate powers who have increased strength, the concentration and centralization of power, have they been intentionally dumbing down America to keep us from believing in our own power? I mean, our founders knew about how you can't really have self-government if people aren't educated. And I wonder if there's been some deliberate effort. I've seen, you know, the de-emphasis of public education, the demonizing of teachers, which is just incredible to me. Maybe that's a little too strong a word. But Mr. Van Roekel, do you see any conscious effort to dumb down America to keep us just as consumers and not citizens?
I would define it in those terms, but I totally agree with you in terms of the shift in how we view education. When I look at the period from right after World War II, 47 to 1980, and that, you know, or to 1979, a 32-year period, think of what we did as a nation. Number one, education was always seen as the solution to the problems or challenges we face as a nation. Right after World War II, GI Bill, millions of returning veterans going to college who have never had an opportunity before. Largest single investment by the federal government in education. Also in that 30-year period, we had the Elementary Secondary Education Act. We had the Individual Disabilities Education Act, Special Education. We had the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. What we had were program after program that were to the benefit of all, to lift everyone up to have these opportunities in our nation. And it was always the solution. One, for me, that was very powerful was the National Defense Education Act.
Yes.
For those who are as old as I am, they remember in 1957 when Sputnik went up and America was behind in the space race. Our response as a nation was to pass the National Defense Education Act with a huge commitment to education, especially in math and science, to give loans to students who were needy and forgiveness of those loans if you went into teaching, which I did. And since then, it's a very different picture. And starting in about 1983 is when I believe it happened with the nation at risk, all of a sudden, education became the problem rather than the solution.
Amazing.
And that shift, I believe, has caused a lot of negative, unintended or not, consequences. And we now, as you say, blame teachers or the education system for the problems that we're facing. This economic crisis was in no way created nor imposed on people because of what teachers were doing in the classroom with students across this country. But they are absolutely having to deal with it, with limiting the budgets in states, cutting of employees, the cutting of programs, narrowing of the curriculum. So I think we need to get back to understand the role education plays, especially in a democracy. It is the great equalizer. It is an investment for our future. And education is not just academic. It's partly that equity issue, making sure that all citizens have it. It's a civic responsibility as to be well-informed and voting participants. And it's really about educating the whole child for a future as an adult in the working world, in the family world, and as part of a bigger community.
Again, we're talking to Dennis Van Roekel, head of the National Education Association. And there's a lot of time. I mean, we've had some tough economic times lately. And instead of putting the blame where it really is, you know, as you say, working people, teachers, firefighters, police, et cetera, have been, you know, may have to face austerity measures. We've seen how well that works in Europe, right? And if we want to build our national economy, which I think there's total agreement in, if we want to be pro-business, how does education fit in there? And a commitment to education. Any business person knows you have to invest prudently to have a more secure economic future. How does this relate to public education?
Well, I love the word that you used there. I believe the tax resources or revenues that we use for education are truly an investment. The return on that dollar, for every dollar spent in education, the return on that investment is far greater than in any other place to use that money. And it's a long-term investment as well as a short-term. And that's what makes it so powerful. When we invested in education in those post-World War II people, we established, post-World War II period, we established the greatest educational experience that anywhere around the world, and people noticed, and they're doing the same thing. Yes. It's not that we've fallen and done worse, it's that the others have gone beyond us because we stopped investing in education. So in these tough economic times, that is not a time to cut back on your investments. You must continue to invest because students can't take 2 or 3 years out of their 12 years of school and say, gosh, I wish we wouldn't have had class sizes of 40 during those my first, second, third grade year in school. So I believe, as you mentioned, it is truly an investment. And we have to start at the earliest ages to make sure we level that playing field and give every student an opportunity. 21st century requires a huge investment in education of all of our citizens, all of our students and adults. And I think that's the direction we need to go.
Again, we're talking to Dennis Van Roekel, head of the NEA. Now, one thing that I believe a lot of teachers and parents have chafed at is the so-called No Child Left Behind. I haven't heard either Romney or Obama talk about No Child Left Behind, which strikes me, correct me if I'm wrong, as kind of tying the hands of teachers and teaching to tests, which doesn't seem to be real productive. Is there a comparison between the two on No Child Left Behind?
President Obama has talked in different times and at times during the campaign about the need to overhaul No Child Left Behind. Part of that, it's the Elementary Secondary Education Act, and it was labeled No Child Left Behind under the reauthorization under George Bush. One of the major changes in that reauthorization that went into effect in January of 2002 was this huge emphasis on standardized tests, required every grade 3 through 8, and only in math and reading. And every measure now is being made based on this high-stakes standardized test. It labels students, schools, districts. They want to pay teachers based on it. And it doesn't make sense because you cannot measure student learning based on one test in one day during the course of the school year.
Really?
Of course, as a teacher, I can tell you, I support tests. I gave a lot of them in my career.
You got to measure.
But those tests were designed for a specific purpose. It was to give me feedback of what students understood and what they didn't understand so I could go back and fill in holes in their understanding. It's a feedback mechanism. It's not a high-stakes picture taking and say, you're a 70 or you're a 50. And that overemphasis on standardized tests, especially only in two subjects, math and reading, what it did is it narrowed the curriculum. It had terrible practices in schools where we had practice tests and gearing for the test and drill. And it just totally changed the what we did during the normal school day. And that is a real negative consequence of No Child Left Behind. So hopefully in the next Congress, they will get to this reauthorization. They will diminish the role of the high-stakes test and instead figure out a way to, again, measure student learning, but for all teachers, not just for some, and to be able to use it as a diagnostic tool to enhance student learning. There are less than half the teachers in schools teach math and reading, so you can't evaluate all teachers using the test score in subjects that most of them don't teach. So we have a real obstacle to overcome there, and I think with the reauthorization, we'll have an opportunity to correct that.
Yeah, cookie cutters may be good for making cookies, but I don't think anything else really.
I think you're right on that one.
And I got to ask, too, we've seen this strain of anti-elitism, anti-intellectualism, which has grown quite a bit in just recent times. People see, you know, if you're smart, if you're educated, oh, you're part of the elite, you know. Is the NEA doing anything about this? This really concerns me.
Well, I can tell you that our members who work in schools every single day do a lot about that. I mean, we know how important it is for students to succeed, and we sure don't want to label success, quote, as failure because you're now an elite or an intellectual. And it's what's interesting about that, too, to me, is that if you look at any child from age 0 to 5, they're like a sponge. They want to learn anything and everything they have an opportunity to learn.
Yeah.
And what we have to do is cultivate that thirst to learn all through school. And I think too often we somehow do things that extinguish it. By the time they graduate from high school, all they want to know is whether it's on the test. In this 21st century, we will never be, quote, done or finished with our education. We are going to be lifelong learners. Technology is changing so fast. So we need to spend more time making sure that students know how to learn. Because we can't predict, even now, for the kids who started kindergarten this year, they're going to graduate in 2025. We don't know what the top 5 occupations in 2025 are.
True.
And things will change dramatically in the next 13 years. But what we have to do is teach them how to learn and to be lifelong learners. So it's not about being an intellectual. It's about surviving in this new world where technology changes oh so fast. And occupations and jobs will constantly require new skills, new knowledge.
We got to compete in the world marketplace. That's just a reality here, and we do seem to be falling behind. And let me ask you, this presidential race at this particular moment in time is currently too close to call, which frankly amazes me. The NEA members could be the deciding factors in those 9 toss-up states. Tell us about that.
Well, first of all, our members do vote. They vote about 18% to 20% higher than the national average.
You know how important it is.
Compliment to our members.
Yes.
Because, first of all, they ought to be doing that.
Of course.
Not only as citizens, but as role models in schools. We've got to get kids to understand that part of your civic responsibility is to be aware of the issues and to vote. In schools across the country, they encourage kids, they don't care which candidate, which race, whether president or city council or mayor or state legislature, it doesn't matter, but have them choose some campaign. Volunteer sometime, just so you understand this incredibly powerful, beautiful process we have called a democracy. So if ever there was a time to be a good role model, it's right now. And our members do that. As I mentioned, they participated at an 18 to 20% higher rate than national average, and they are enthusiastic activists. In 2008, we had about 200,000 of our members who actively participated in the presidential race. This year, it's right at 500,000, and I'm proud of that number. I think that's one of our responsibilities as citizens, and I'm glad the members of NEA so take that responsibility so seriously. And we will make a difference in those battleground states because we have members in every single state and every single congressional district, so we will make a difference.
That's really good to hear. And I just got to ask, I have been amazed at how a lot of people these days seem to tune in more to the candidate's style than the substance of what he or she is actually saying. That seems to me to reflect, frankly, a level and caring about education. I'm amazed at that. That degrades our democracy very, very much. It's got to be.
Well, we've become a society of 30-second soundbites. And we have to encourage all adults, whether they be in school or out of school, to take the time and to really look into the issue and understand why one is the pros and cons of different directions. It's not about being right or wrong. It's about choosing a solution that you believe is in the best interest of America.
Yeah.
You know, as we face these incredible times right after the election on sequestration and trying to balance this budget and deal with soaring health care costs, as a nation, we only have 535 people who get a vote on that. The members
That's
of
right.
Congress.
That's right.
And we ought to be informed so that we can tell them what we believe is in the best interest of the American people and our nation. So I think it's a responsibility and an obligation for all of us to get involved, understand the issue, and not rely on a 30-second soundbite to define a position on an issue or a candidate.
Which brings us back to a lot of the founders talked about how in order to have self-government, in order to have a republic and not something like a plutocracy, people have to be educated. It's essential to participate. Thank you so much for being with us. Dennis Van Rokel, head of the NEA. What's the website people can check out for the National Education Association?
They can go to NEA.org, NEA.org.
Thank you so much. You're a good teacher. Thanks so much, and let's hope for good things ahead and that we understand the value of education. It's just amazing to me. Thank you so much, Dennis Van Rokel.
All right. Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
All right. We'll be back in just a minute. We have Michael Winship on the line here, and he works with Bill Moyers and Company. He is a senior writer of Moyers Company on public television, senior writing fellow at the policy and advocacy group Demos, and president of the Writers Guild of America. And we are going to talk now about plutocracy, what that is, what a gilded age is. Michael, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Bert. How are you?
Oh, not bad. Not bad. It certainly is interesting times as we look ahead to what the future direction of this nation is going to be very, very soon. And you have said in an article, and what we're going to talk about is that a new gilded age is roaring down on us. Now, frankly, here it is, 2012. Hardly anyone knows what you mean when you refer to the gilded age. Gilded age. I wonder if you could just briefly explain what it was. And what was the effect on politics and the locus of power in this democracy, in this republic? And what was it like in the Gilded Age for people who were not part of the super rich?
Right. Well, the Gilded Age, actually, it was dubbed that. I believe the first one to dub it that was Mark Twain, who wrote a novel with a partner called The Gilded Age. And basically, we're talking about the latter part of the 19th century and the very beginning of the 20th century, when there was outrageous power and wealth concentrated in the hands of a very, very few business tycoons who were so wealthy and had so much that they actually they used to joke that the Senate, the U.S. Senator, the senators would be instead of the senator from Massachusetts or the senator from Tennessee, they'd be the senator from the Union Pacific Railroad or the senator from Standard Oil. They had that kind of power then and that kind of clout. And it was another case, as we're seeing now, where you basically had a 99% versus a 1%, with the 1% at the wheel. And of course, their political power was such that they were able to fight back regulation. They were able to keep wages down ridiculously. They finally were overcome by people like Teddy Roosevelt, who writers like Upton Sinclair and others, who exposed the horrors of what they were creating without any kind of regulation and without any kind of power to the people. So you had Teddy Roosevelt, you had William Jennings Bryan in 1896, all these people who fought and got, you know, a lot fixed and a lot changed in that era. But we really seem to be approaching another Gilded Age now, which is what Bill and I were writing about last week.
And what was it like for the average person? I know that one of the things that Upton Sinclair is most famous for, and he wrote many, many books and came close to being governor of California in 1932, I believe it was, or maybe it was 34. But the jungle where without regulations, the meat packers specifically, it was horrible conditions. The food was incredibly unsafe and diseased and rotten and things like that. Is it an exaggeration to say that some of the people who seem to have Mitt Romney's ear want to do away with regulations? They see regulations as the enemy that is holding down our economy.
Well, we've certainly seen things that have been happening in terms of pulling back on regulatory moves and on the staffing in various regulatory agencies. We're seeing it right now with the FDA, for example, some of the stuff that's been happening with food in terms of food poisoning in the United States, and then this whole issue and the compounding steroids that are causing the viral meningitis, bacterial meningitis, all that sort of thing is happening. And my fear is that a lot of these people, as you say, have Governor Romney's ear and would like to see a lot of these agencies, if not completely eliminated, certainly drawn back, reined back in. We certainly have been seeing it in the mining industry, for example. One of Romney's big supporters is Bob Murray, the CEO of Murray Energy. And, of course, he's somebody who has been fined millions and millions of dollars for violating safety regulations in his mine. There have been injuries. There have been deaths. And at the same time, in the last two years, he's donated more than $900,000 to Republican politicians.
And yeah, it was interesting in the article you refer to a photograph of Romney standing there, buddies with coal miners in Ohio, looking like he's for the average working Joe. Was it not their choice to be there?
It wasn't. You're right. It made him look like he was standing for the average working Joe, and conversely, that the average working Joe was standing for him.
Right.
They actually were told that they had to be at that rally without pay. Murray Energy told them that their attendance there was mandatory.
Mandatory. How much of that is going on now? I mean, we hear about the infamous Koch brothers who have tremendous fortunes, and timeshare mogul David Siegel. Specifically, are they doing things like that, requiring their employees, their thousands of employees, to take a certain political position?
Well, we're hearing more and more about this, and it's one of the interesting surprises. And this was first reported by Mike Elk, who you probably know is a terrific young labor reporter at In These Times magazine. What we've discovered is that one of the side effects of the Citizens United decision, which we didn't realize, was that the justices really effectively overturned the rules that keep bosses from ordering employees to do political work on company time. Now, we talked to, that piqued my interest reading Mike's coverage, and Bill Moyers and I spoke with Trevor Potter, who, you know, is the election law expert. He's the guy that Stephen Colbert used to set up his super PAC. And Trevor told us that corporations now argue that it's a constitutionally protected use of corporate resources. to order employees to do political work or attend events. You know, they can't, as far as we know, they can't demand that people vote the way they do, that they insist upon, but we're hearing more and more reports of people being called into meetings of employees and being lectured to by CEOs and so forth, telling them the way they should vote. I mean, it's the same thing that we see. You know, you mentioned that I'm president of the Writers Guild of America East, and I've seen this tactic used by management for years, where they will call in employees who are interested in possibly organizing and joining a union, and they'll call them in and lecture them and hector them and tell them why they're not supposed to support a union.
It reminds me somehow of Tsarist Russia somehow. It doesn't...
Well, it's funny. Last week on our show, we had Matt Taibbi from Rolling Stone and Chrystia Freeland from Thomson Reuters, who's just written this book, Plutocrats. And oddly enough, both Matt and Chrystia were in Russia when Russia started falling apart and when Boris Yeltsin started basically selling off industry that had been run by government. Yeltsin sold all that off, oil and the mines and all that sort of stuff, to private billionaires who really have taken over the wealth of Russia. And they were saying that it's not dissimilar to what's happening in America, with the difference that, at least so far, we haven't seen, you know, bodies showing up on doorsteps. It's pretty ruthless in Russia in terms of getting rid of your competition through violence. We haven't seen that as much in this country. But it's not dissimilar in terms of the way that people are a very small handful, the plutocrats, if you will, or what they call the kleptocrats in Russia, have taken over.
Well, as people who listen to this show know, I often refer, and you reminded me once again, a professor I had in college who defined politics as the economy of violence. It hasn't come down to that yet, but...
No.
You know, it is largely about scaring people and controlling people through some threats of, frankly, violence. And as you were describing the belief by some of these plutocrats that Citizens United decision gives them the legal authority to enable them to control the votes of their employees, you couldn't hear my jaw drop. It doesn't come across on radio, but I cannot imagine that they would have much of a legal leg to stand on that, or...
I know.
Or would they?
I think, in fact, you know, when we were talking to Trevor Potter, I think that he's contemplating the idea of litigation on this. I don't think it won't take place until after the election, but it's something to look ahead toward. It's certainly going to be at the tip of the spear on the effort to get campaign finance reform back on track, that I'm sure we'll see after Election Day. I think you're already seeing reported in the Times this week, for example, the number of members of Congress who are, you know, realizing now the enormity of what Citizens United has done in terms of unleashing all this money.
And it could be seen, or it is seen by a great many people, as a real threat to democracy and plutocracy.
There's no question, yeah.
Plutocracy, I believe, is simply government of, by, and for the very rich. The aristocracy.
Yes, absolutely. And it's something that we've been trying to talk about on our programs and in our columns for quite some time now.
And if you just tuned into the Burt Cohen Show, our guest today is Michael Winship, who has served as president of the Writers Guild East since 2007 and a senior writer of the public TV series Moyers and Company and its website, BillMoyers.com. He's been with, done a lot of work with a lot of different TV, PBS, CBS, A&E, all those things. And we're talking about the threat of plutocracy. Now, a lot of people, frankly, are scared these days. And clearly the Republicans have been masters at manipulating fear. And FDR knew what he was talking about, saying that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear makes people do things that may not necessarily be the best for the future. People are afraid of a second term of Obama. Somehow the Republicans have said, oh, he'll turn it into, you know, he'll just nationalize all industries, you know, turn it into a Marxist state, which is, of course, absurd. But what about on the other hand, people, it seems more and more people believe that by freeing up the market, doing away with regulations, that may be the key to creating more jobs and improving the American economy. Well, what's wrong with that?
Well, what's wrong with it is that the free market isn't, you know, isn't uh, isn't the ideal that Adam Smith and others purported it to be, that, you know, you assume that market forces will operate in a certain way, and they don't. And it turns out that people take advantage. The extreme wealthy, not satisfied with the amount of wealth they have, take on more wealth. And what you also see, and there are increasing studies indicating that when you do this, when people sort of, you know, have this enormous wealth and basically pull up the ladder behind them,
right,
thus cutting off the middle class and thus cutting off any other kind of people who want to get in on the game and who want to be entrepreneurial, that you really have quite the opposite effect. You don't create jobs, you cut jobs.
Hmm.
You affect economic growth.
Interesting. It does seem that, as you describe it, pulling up the ladder once you've climbed up there, that I get the sense that there's a lot of that feeling around. And
well, I think so. You know, the metaphor that we used at the beginning of the article that you've so kindly been talking about is a residential skyscraper that's going up,
yes,
a couple of blocks away from our building called 157. And it's on 57th Street, right over by Carnegie Hall. And
mm-hmm.
those top apartments are going for $90 million. And the more the fixer-uppers are going for $45 to $50 million. And basically, I mean, it really is a situation where you're going to have people at the top of this building with these panoramic views of the New York City skyline, sort of, you know, being in their observation posts, looking down on the results of their class warfare.
Quite literally.
Yes, that, exactly.
That really is amazing to think about it.
And another thing that's really interesting about this, that with this sort of bloat of you know, what's happening with the defense industry and even in education, is that you're seeing this bloat also translate into the machine that runs elections now. You know, I mean, you've
what
got
do you mean?
Billions of dollars going into local television advertising. You're seeing profits go up for local TV stations,
oh, yeah,
something like 15%. You've got millions, something, you know, as much as $3 billion, I've seen, dollars being spent on campaign consultants and other kinds of vendors. And so you've got this never-ending campaign that just feeds on this, you know, that continues to feed on all this money that's been unleashed by Citizens United. And what's intriguing about that to me is that, you know, this will never stop now.
Unless we change Citizens United.
Exactly.
I mean, the idea that, exactly, that these advertisements are, you know, just calling all the shots and they're defining everything because that's what people see.
Right.
It's not what at least a lot of the founders intended. Now, it's true, some of the founders, when they created the U.S. Senate, that was supposed to be a place for aristocrats only, and the
right
people were not supposed to vote on that. So,
mm-hmm,
so this struggle between, you know, should it be an aristocracy that runs the country or a real democracy has been going on for a couple of hundred.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you remember from your history lessons that they debated whether or not George Washington should be a king.
That's right.
And this has been going on ever since. But you mentioned the television ads, and we talked about the television ads and the enormous amount of profits that are going into that this year. One of the most chilling comments I heard was from Leslie Moonves, the CEO of CBS,
uh-huh,
who basically told a stockholders meeting, it may not be good for America, but it's good for CBS.
Great.
You know, and quite the opposite of the old, when I think it was Coolidge who originally said, what's good for America is, what's good for business is good for America.
Right.
He's saying what's bad for America is good for CBS.
Oh, that's good to keep in mind. And I was amazed, I have to say, at some of the figures you talked about in the article about New York City, how the bottom 20%, the average income is, well, you can tell us.
Well, we really have discovered that New York's, the economic inequality in New York City is not unlike that of a lot of third world nations.
Yeah.
Of America's 25 largest cities, we're now the most unequal. The median income for the bottom 20% here last year was less than $9,000, while the top 1% has an average annual income of $2.2 million. And of course, it doesn't help that we've got a billionaire mayor who doesn't see anything wrong with this.
Well, a lot of people don't see anything wrong with that. I still have a hard time figuring out how it is that, you know, middle-income, lower-income people identify with the plutocrats and support the plutocrats as if...
Well, and again, that goes right back to what you were saying about the founders in the Continental Congress. You had people who were in Philadelphia when they were debating the Declaration of Independence, basically saying what you're saying. And, you know, there's always been this aspirational aspect in America, which is wonderful on the one hand, but also creates this sort of sensation of well, you know, someday maybe I'll be that rich.
Right.
So I don't want to do anything to the rich people because someday I may have those same privileges, which is less and less realistic.
Oh, yeah. And I find it fascinating how some of the more right-wing candidates have replaced the word very conveniently, you know, super wealthy with job creators.
Right, exactly. And it's really quite the opposite, as
of
we
course.
Were saying.
Of course.
There are more and more studies. Christian Freeland actually compared it to Venice in the Renaissance when you had the merchants who had who were the job creators and creating the wealth reaching a certain point where they basically closed themselves off in a society that would take no one else in, which completely stifled innovation and technology and growth.
Oh,
same thing's happening now.
Fascinating. We talk about the huge disparity in wealth, specifically in New York City. I mean, what an amazing snapshot. There was no small degree of success, I thought, for Occupy Wall Street. Because, I mean, just the fact that the 99% idea, everybody knew it. Everybody understood it. That there's the 99% that are not served and the 1% that are served really well. Why is it that that incredible disparity, the inequality gap, has never been mentioned in any of these debates?
I know. It's shocking. It hasn't been mentioned in any of the debates. So many things that weren't mentioned in the debates. But, you know, they talked about Obama in the second debate raised the 47% that Romney talked about, that famous video with the fundraiser. He mentioned that, but none of them are talking about this vast gulf. And I think that part of the problem is that, again, going back to what you were saying about the aspirational nature of so much of this, where people hope that they can be that wealthy someday or win the lottery or whatever the heck they think they're going to do, that somehow puts people off when you talk about this disparity. Also, we have a problem in this country, and the people who are really at the bottom of the 99%, the people who most need to express themselves and take a stand, don't necessarily vote.
I know. They feel powerless.
It's an issue, you know. They feel powerless, and understandably.
Yeah, understandably. Like, they don't have any control over their lives for the most part, so why should this be any different? I know.
Right, and this is why it kills me when people like Governor Romney and Paul Ryan talk about the increase in the number of people on food stamps. Well, who caused that?
Right. Well, the Republicans have, you know, they never tired of charging Democrats of instigating class warfare.
Well, and it always reminds me of that old joke about the children who murder their parents and then you know, plead for clemency because they're orphans.
Right.
You know, I mean, so much of this has been perpetrated by direct action or by inertia in Congress.
Well, it does seem,
and then they try to make it a campaign issue.
Well, it does seem to me that it has some resonance that when we point out class warfare, they say we're instigating class warfare. It's like when people on the left point out racism, they instantly say we are racist for pointing out racism.
Well,
they say, and I got to ask you, they say that we on the left are practicing the politics of envy. That seems to have some traction.
I know. I don't personally feel envious, you know, and it was Warren Buffett who said, yeah, there's a class war. We started it, meaning the billionaires,
right,
and we're winning.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we're talking, if you just tuned in, with Michael Winship, who has a long resume, senior writer with the public television series Moyers and Company, and you can go to the website, Bill Moyers and Company. Is this, do you think that I mean, Democrats have traditionally been the party of working people, and yet, as we've recognized, they haven't talked about the 99% issue. Do you think this could be a more winning issue had they grabbed onto it? I kind of think people understood it and resonated with it, and that we may be missing an opportunity by not talking about this.
Bert, I totally agree with you on that one. I think, you know, there have been some members of Congress who said, you know, in fact, the whole Occupy Wall Street movement, the whole notion of the 99% did affect the dialogue. I mean, did you know, when you look at the charts of media mentions, I mean, it was unbelievable, the spike in the number of media mentions of economic and income inequality that took place when Occupy Wall Street began last September of 2011.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of the Democratic politicians said, yes, in fact, this did, you know, motivate a lot of the dialogue that was going on. But they haven't taken sufficient advantage of it. I think it could be used very effectively, and I wouldn't be surprised if it is yet again. I think, you know, for whatever organizational problems that Occupy has had, it still is a very, very powerful idea.
I thought the communication was tremendously successful, more than, frankly, I would have imagined.
I know.
Well, what has happened to the party of working people? Why aren't Democrats talking about
well,
this?
Well, you know, Bert, once again, it comes down to the money, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There's just so damn much money. And when you turn aside public financing, as both Obama and Romney have done, and mm-hmm. as Obama did in 2008, when you take the teeth out of campaign finance reform, as Citizens United did, you know, all of a sudden the spigots are open and the money is flowing, and you need to get as much of it as you can. So you find, you know, President Obama, I can't remember the number of days that he has spent fundraising. You have situations where both the president and Governor Romney have been going to states that they really have no electoral chance in at all, but they're where the money is. You see,
mm-hmm.
Governor Romney here in New York, you know, New York will go very solidly for Obama.
Nope,
But Romney is here with, you know, collecting as much money from the corporate ATM as he possibly can.
Corporate ATM. Well, if there's no campaign finance reform, what chance is there of us restoring our democracy and beating back the plutocracy and the big finance interests that seem to always be in charge?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, as I say, there was this report in the Times this week with different members of Congress realizing, you know, who are feeling it heavily, where they're being just, you know, jumped on by all of this money that are saying, you know, that we have to do something about it. But I always remember a piece that Meg Greenfield wrote a number of years ago at the Washington Post, where she compared campaign finance reform to the squirrel-proof bird feeder and the impossibility of creating the squirrel-proof bird feeder. Because no matter how effectively you build a bird feeder to keep away the squirrels, they eventually figure out a way in.
Something about the basic law of supply and demand, wherever, mm-hmm. you know, the campaign finance reform tries to control the supply, but if there's a demand, the squirrels are going to get the food.
Yeah, exactly.
So somehow, I mean, there are lots of other countries where each party, each candidate only has a certain amount of time on the public airwaves, and let's remember they are the public airwaves, and that lessens the demand. But how unique is this time in terms of the threat, the prospect of our republic being replaced by a plutocracy? Is it more severe now?
I think it's more severe now. I think... you know, on the one hand, because we've had this explosion in media, there are more ways for people to learn about what's going on and what's happening, which certainly didn't exist in Mark Twain's time when he was writing about the Gilded Age. On the other hand, that same media, I think, sort of tranquilizes the society and keeps them from getting up and doing something about this. So I do worry about something really severe happening, but also that really severe happening may finally motivate the vast middle class and lower classes and so forth who need to take more control.
Well, we'll find out fairly soon, November 6th.
Yes, we will. We will indeed. It'll be an interesting night.
Oh, my goodness. And as you say, the Gilded Age might be roaring down upon us. And once was enough. The 1890s were bad enough. And it's funny how it seems like the only thing we learn from history is that we never learn from history.
Exactly.
Michael Winship, thank you so much. The website, I guess the best one is BillMoyers.com, unless there's some other website you want to point us to for you.
No, that's the one, BillMoyers.com.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show, and let's hope we can keep our republic and a democracy. Thank you.
It's the time of the season. Love runs high in this time, give it to me easy, and let me try with pleasured hands to take you in this time to promised lands, to show you everyone it's the time of the season for love. What's your name? Who's your daddy?
Who's your daddy? Be rich.
Is he rich like me? Has he taken
any time to show
you what you need to live?
Tell it to me slowly.
Tell you why
I really want to know. It's the time of the season for love.
Like me,
has he taken
any time
to show
you what you need to live?
Tell it to me slowly.
Tell you why
I really want to know. It's the time of the season for love.